Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
From the blackest corners of your mind, they call. Pulling you deep into shadow, twisting your senses, keeping you from sleep. It's time to face your darkest fears. This is Tales to Terrify.
Good evening, children of the night, and welcome. I'm your host, Drew Sebesti. What? Oh yeah, that's not me. Good evening, children of the night, and welcome. I'm your host, Spencer Disparti. I serve as the assistant editor, a slush reader, and occasional narrator for this wonderful podcast. My journey with Tales to Terrify started, give or take, about 5 years ago, when I dipped my toe into the narrating pool. As a longtime fan of audiobooks, radio dramas, and all things spooky, I wanted to give it a shot, and I haven't looked back since. Before that, though, my true passion was, and still is, music. Now, if you don't mind what sounds like a cat dying while a jackhammer is pounding away in the background, then you'll love my music. You can find all of my work at soundcloud.com/thegirionband. Speaking of that, I thought it would be fun to talk about just that, music. Not just any music, but music in horror, specifically horror films. Now, I can't tell you how many times I've watched a movie and gotten literal chills from a perfectly placed note or a haunting melody. It sticks in my head for days on end. Music and film have a long history together, and one cannot survive without the other. It is, in essence, a symbiotic relationship. And composers certainly don't have it easy, as the right score can make or break a movie. The great thing about music and horror that makes it beautifully unique is the way it taps into the human psyche. The rawest of emotions. Fear. Horror soundtracks are meant to evoke an emotional reaction that triggers the fight-or-flight response within us. Now, how do film composers do this? Well, a myriad of ways. But the two main ingredients that are the foundation of a good horror score are minor keys and dissonance. Minor keys give off a lugubrious, plaintive tone, which are instrumental to creating a sense of foreboding. The other ingredient is dissonance. Now, what do I mean by dissonance? Well, it's usually chords or notes that clash, that are unsettling to listen to. Most of the time, they are accidental notes, notes that aren't typically found in the scale being played. This evokes a sense of dread or anxiety. For example, Hans Zimmer's score in The Dark Knight. All he uses is one cello playing two notes, the root, and a note a half step up. This false harmonic creates tension, a feeling that something bad is going to happen, a buildup to something unknown. This is what makes a good film great. In the early days, there weren't quote-unquote proper soundtracks composed from scratch. Instead, many directors and composers repurposed existing pieces of classical music to complement a certain scene. That all changed when sound was introduced to movies, and the first horror movie to have a soundtrack was 1922's Nosferatu, directed by F.W. Murnau. Unfortunately, the original score has been lost, replaced in 1997 with new music by James Bernard. Through the 30s to 50s, composers created these grandiose scores to go with the big scenes of such horror classics as Frankenstein, Dracula, and The Creature from the Black Lagoon. These movies all featured stentorian, operatic, orchestral scores, and not much in the area of sound design or effects. All of this changed in 1960 with Alfred Hitchcock. Take Bernard Herrmann's screeching track in Psycho. You know which scene I'm talking about. Those slashing notes of the violins, shredding the audience as much as the hapless Marion Crane. Can you believe that Alfred Hitchcock originally did not want music in this scene? I can't imagine it. For the last 40 or so years in horror cinema, there has been a shift to more experimental, minimalist compositions. Look at such films as The Conjuring, Suspiria, A Dark Song, and the ever-enduring Halloween soundtrack by John Carpenter. Part of this had to do with budget. The other had to do with technology. Once the synthesizer was introduced, it took the music industry by storm, and that included film scoring. The synthesizer was an integral part of film scoring during the 80s, especially for the slasher film genre. Horror film scoring is not just an art, but a science as well. Although there is a formula, like any art form, these rules can and will be broken. That's what makes art great. It is ever-changing. From the ubiquitous jump scare, to the disturbing drone note, to the heart-pounding thump of a bass when the killer is chasing down its prey. Horror film music will always have a special place in our dark and twisted hearts. So the next time you sit down to watch that scary flick, I encourage you to pay attention to the music behind the screams.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Our first story for the evening comes from Renan Bernardo. Renan Bernardo is a science fiction and fantasy writer from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. His fiction appeared in Apex Magazine, Podcastle, Escape Pod, Dark Recesses Press, Dark Matter Magazine, and others. His solarpunk cli-fi short fiction collection, Different Kinds of Defiance, is upcoming by Android Press. His fiction has also appeared in multiple languages, including German, Italian, Japanese, and Portuguese. He can be found at Twitter at Renan Bernardo and his website, renanbernardo.com. Children of the Night, join me for Renan Bernardo's Curse Lifter, first published in Dark Recesses Press, Volume 6, Issue 16.
Munzer coughs blood into the scarf wrapped around her neck and wipes her lips with the frayed cloth. Cursing others is cursing a little bit of yourself. The words of her former instructors rattle in her mind, and still she goes on. Aki groans in his sickness, twitching his toothless mouth into what is probably a smile. She kneels before his bed and dips a finger in the bone meal mixture lying next to it, infused with herbs and ashes. She lays a fingertip on his wrinkled forehead, and the solution drips onto his cheeks. To him, she's there to lift the curse that ravages his lands, crops, and his body. But no, Munzer is cursing him, ensuring that he dies in a few weeks. Pressing a bit harder, Munzer scratches Aki's forehead. Blood fuses with blackness, skin with pestled herbs, sweat with bone dust, descending across his face. He grimaces, then smiles, his mouth an ignorant cleft on a cobweb of dark red lines. Aki takes her hand and squeezes it, grateful, weak. His fingers crush some of the pustules that cover her wrist. She flinches and wheezes. She's been pushing herself farther across the wretched lands for 3 months since her family's death, grabbing coins in works of dissolution and extreme anguish. An unpleasant job, but one she needs in order to bury her family's bones in the Towers of the Dead. Only russets can rent a grave chamber there, and Aki's wife has a purse full of them. Munzer lets go of the man's hand. Sunlight filters through the paneled window, bringing out the blackened droplets that pockmark his wrinkles. The festering odor of her craft pervades the room. It's done. In the foyer, a grin forms on the mouth of Aki's wife. Arbella rises from cushions more tattered than the tapestries hanging from the cracked walls. Her sunken eyes glint, two scarabs' bodies in wait of an answer.
So?
Munzer nods.
Look at this place, Arbella says. Rotten, all because of him.
Customers think curse lifters care about their past. Munzer extends her hand, palm up. Arbella puts a bag of coins in it and squints her eyes.
You seem sick. The price of curses.
She needs to see Gula.
So you?
Munzer seizes the bag of coins and walks outside before Arbella finishes her words. Dead, rusty leaves waft from the sparse trees among the conglomerate of stone houses and fractured cobblestone on Aki's lands. The gaunt horses she and Gula stole from a farmstead wait for them, tied to stakes, eating the tall, dry grass of the property. Gula is sitting on a stone next to them, gnawing a half-rotten corn cob. Is he going to die? The wind tousles Gula's greasy hair. At her side, a crow caws and pecks corn grains from the soil. Munzer sits next to her, shooing the bird.
He wasn't a good man.
She recoils from Gula's touch. She can't stain Gula with the impurity of cursing. Gula should worry about that thick black mixture on her fingers. It's where curses reside.
You won't hurt me, Gula says, pulling Munzer's hand back. Munzer kisses Gula's cheek, catching a whiff of the dirt they've been dragging with them across the wretched lands. It's been weeks since they last found a clean stream. Gula takes a kerchief from her bag and starts to scrub Munzer's hands and wrists. The pustules around your wrists have all burst, and they're not blistering anymore. Gula sighs. But you're still sick. Love, you have to stop with these curses.
I won't. I...
You can't. I know. But I had to give my advice as your physician and partner. Munzer lowers her head.
Udrin was only 7.
She mouths those words to convince herself. And the gods had stalled her brother's passing. He'd gurgled his way to death in blood and wailing. She had to... The crow brought this, Gula says, rummaging inside her frayed tunic to produce a parched letter. Munzer grabs the letter and unrolls the paper, careful not to tear it. Work in Irmshar, Munzer says, reading the hurried handwriting twice.
The merchant lord of Irmshar wants to spurn his daughter for hindering his business.
Irmshar is not far, Gula points to the west. But I think you need some days to rest.
No. The longer my family is buried elsewhere than the towers, the longer they'll remain stranded in the dark. Can our horses make it?
They're in better shape than us. They get up and start to prepare the tired animals to ride. On the road they'll have to follow, skeletons jut out of the ground as quiet reminders of the bane. Is it bothering you? Gula says. The merchant's daughter?
No,
she lies, the horse's reins dangling from her hands. Her mind fills with her mother's face, mouth beaten by disease in blotted purple clefts. Her mother was on her knees, begging for her children to be speculars, God's favored people immune to curses and diseases, so rare in the world it would be easier to pray for the gods themselves to come. But they didn't have the glossed eyes of speculars. Weeks later, her mother grumbled how she didn't want to lose Udrin, not understanding she was going to depart before him. Say a prayer for hope and protection, her mother used to say when they set out on a road. Munzer closes her eyes, trying to evoke something from the back of her mind, from a time where life didn't mean traipsing through the wretched lands, where her profession meant saving people from curses, not dooming them. Let's go, Gula says, softly touching her hands, pulling her out of her past. Munzer nods, mounting her horse. Her mother's shrill supplications will escort her on the road. Mercy, mercy for my son, mercy. Oh, you gods, can't you hear me, please?
I didn't know you curse lifters were so miserable, says Ortnar.
He fidgets with the golden necklace around his neck, propping one hand on the table and casting a frown at Munzer. She's in a tight office in his manor. Gula waits outside. Munzer's not fond of including her in any part of the business.
I'm lucky you arrived before dawn. Otherwise, it'd be obvious you're here to do something nasty. Do you want to make yourself comfortable?
The merchant lord points to a chair with torn seat. Munzer shakes her head. Chatting is unimportant, but her customers love to do it. It's as if it can unburden them from their guilt and shame. Frequently, they hiss out justifications and enumerate excuses.
Our deal must be secret, and I'm not interested in anything but your russets.
Her voice is hoarse, but her body feels less achy. Gula had tossed potions down her throat when she almost fell off the horse, dizzy and sunburnt, at the broken gates of Irmshar.
She is called Anatu.
Ortnar looks outside, twiddling his fingers around his necklace, probably deciding how to phrase his words without looking guilty. They all do that.
She's in collusion with my rivals. My daughter is my enemy now. She doesn't realize that without my business, she won't have the russet to ride a horse and meet her collaborators. Can you imagine? My daughter.
He falls silent. A gust carries the smell of the city in through the window. Offal, tallow candles, rotten fish, either from the filthy river or the huts of the market that lingers in a crumbled world.
I need her to die. I think it's clear by now. Knives are messy.
Yes, they are. At least Udrin's eyes were closed before she'd freed him from life and pain.
I informed the guards and servants that you're here to bless the manor. I also studied Anatu's behavior and... You want a disease, something natural.
Munzer completes his thought.
You want your people seeing her sneezing, down, barely able to walk your filthy streets. Something she ate, or perhaps some leftover from the Bane diseases.
I like you.
Ortnar smiles. It's the first time he takes his fingers off the necklace. He sighs. His breath is like the city's.
I can offer you 200 russets.
Fair. She can barter, drain a bit more from the man, but 200 is more than what she needs to end her travails and bring deliverance for her family. Only then will Udrin be able to dry the blood on his face and tread the path of light with their mother and father. And only then she'll rest her mind for sliding a knife across his throat. Ortnar opens the door and beckons her to leave.
Follow the main courtyard and get down the ramp at the other side. Anatu's room is the first door you'll see. She's awake by now, preparing her treacherous business. Dawn is coming, so try to be quick since your kind draws attention. I'll think of the burial.
Munzer leaves the office. Do you want to leave? Gula asks as soon as Ortnar is distanced enough. She clasps Munzer's hand as they walk to the other side. Munzer says no, but the word gets caught in her dry throat. The courtyard is silent and empty. A ballista lies broken by the corner, barely lit by the torches that burn on the battered arcades. Ivy coils through rubble and cracked furniture in what once might have been a garden. From small terraces above her, beheaded and dismembered statues look down, silhouettes against the moon. When they reach the ramp to the basement section, Munzer stops.
Stay.
She raises a hand to Gula. Gula's lips twist. I don't like to leave you alone.
Stay.
A curse is supposed to be wrought only in the presence of the cursed, and she can't fall back now. She's not sure if she would be able to proceed with Gula watching. Munzer descends the ramp. The door to Anato's room is open. It's a tight place with only a bed, a table, and a barrel set next to the door. Candles wither on rusty sconces, giving off aromas of flowers long forgotten. Their light gilds the clean sheets of Anatu's bed. Bent on a crooked table with her back to the door, Anatu mutters something to herself. She's nothing but a young woman, about 17. She twiddles her fingers, sorting or counting up russets on the table. A rag doll sewn with paws that resemble those of a lizard stands beside a small pile of coins like a useless fabric guardian.
I'm sorry to interrupt,
Munzer says, and her voice contorts in a catarrhal expectoration. She covers her mouth with a hand. Anatu turns, wrinkling her nose. A burning kind of innocence smolders in her eyes like remnants of firewood crackling in a hearth. Her cheeks are smooth. Her hair falls in curls in front of her forehead. Who are you? Anatu says. Munzer puts her bag on the floor. She has never cursed a person so young. What is that? Anatu's brows knit together.
I'm here to bring luck to your family. Perform some rituals, Munzer says.
A shoddy excuse. The girl's almost a child. She'll kill a young one.
Again.
My father told me someone would come to bless the manor. I don't believe in these rituals. I'm sorry. Anatu swivels back to her coins, jaw set and back tensed. You may go.
I can't.
Munzer pulls the cords that tie her bag and opens it. She picks up two bone meal vials and herbs blackened by ashes, coal, and bruise. She puts them on the barrel next to the bedroom's door. It won't be as easy as Aki. She will need all the bone meal. It will make the girl fall ill instantly and perhaps one day later surrender her body. It won't be good for her own health, but the girl deserves a quick death. At least she can choose how and when the girl will depart. She couldn't with Udrin. The Bane didn't pick whose belly it would empty, whose skin it would wreck, whose bowels it would fill with blood. I said you may go. Anatu stands.
I bring relief, Anatu. I do. You are all here in the School of Assistance to bring good fortune and relief to people.
Munzer opens the bone meal vials and dips her fingers into the brownish gob. She has to do it fast. Before those curls and that velvety voice hinder her. You're a curse lifter, Anatu says. These things, I've read about your kind, you're all degenerates these days.
I have to bury my family. I have to bring Afterlife to Udrin. She'd put a hand over Udrin's mouth as if able to keep the blood inside him, to make it stream back through his body while he gurgled.
It will be quick.
Munzer promises what she had promised Udrin in the end, slithering a knife across his throat to end the weeks of the Bane's impiety.
I'm dangerous.
Anatu pulls a knife from her belt.
Get out!
Munzer squashes the black leaves atop the meal scattered on the barrel. A gleam sparkles in Anatu's eyes, silvery and unnatural, not cast by the candlelight. Anatu thrusts her knife forward. Munzer dodges, her concoction running down her wrists and scrawling down her arms like cold-drenched rivers. Before the girl can attack again, Munzer scrapes the barrel and eats the mixture of herbs and bone dust. The bedroom swirls. It's the fastest way, the hardest, a path she rarely treads upon. The light of the candles flare to gray, spirits casting their iniquity on the walls, lengthening shadows, corroding light. A sound rams into her skull, rattling it like bones clacking with each other, crumbling to dust. Her eyes burn. The bedroom wobbles with cold. All the hairs on her body bristle.
Get out of here!
The vibrations of the girl's yell jolt Munzer's muscles, throb her heart. They're like food, enlivening the gray lights, bringing Udrin's face to the front of her mind, screaming, red lips writhing in pain, begging for his mother. The slice of the knife through his throat had a sound more fleeting than the sheathing of the blade. Munzer raises her hands, black as death. As little as a scratch on Anatu's face would be enough to blend her blood with the mixture and complete the curse.
Keep away!
Anatu's beautiful face smears into grayness like blotches of ink on paper. Munzer scratches at her. Anatu dodges to the side. Her knees get caught on the bed. She staggers. Munzer leaps and slaps the girl's arm, sending the knife flying away from her hand. It clinks on the floor. She grabs Anatu's arms. The touch makes gray powder puff from her hands. Somewhere outside, Gula yells her name.
I don't want,
Anatu says, her eyes swelling with tears and dust. Munzer can't dawdle now. With four nails, she slashes a thin stripe on the girl's forehead. Anatu closes her eyes, arms softening, surrendering, like Udrin did. Blood runs down to her eyelids, staining it.
You're not the first I hurt, Anatu says.
Hurt me? Munzer stammers, shivering. She pulls away her nails. Someone grasps her elbow. She spins and sees Gula's sooted cheeks and wide eyes. Go away, Munzer pushes back Gula's hand. I must be alone. The ashen lights of the candles flicker, burning as if they're afraid, wanting to melt and escape this place. The bedroom drowns in the stony, thawing smell of wax infected with the foul scent of curse. Anatu opens her eyes. Two pearly mirrors. Gula pulls Munzer, tearing the frazzled silk of her scarf, and stands in front of her. She's reflecting the curse, Gula mutters, though already ensnared by Anatu's gaze. Anatu cries, little gems coursing down from glazed eyes locked on Gula. What have you done? Munzer moans, using the nearby barrel to get on her knees. She pulls Gula's ragged tunic down. Gula, what do you mean?
A specular, Gula says.
Please, make my children speculars, her mother had prayed to heedless gods. May they go through this pain intact. May their eyes shine. Munzer grabs Gula's shoulders. Gula's arms lie against her sides like withered twigs under the wind's blow. Speculars can't be fouled. Diseases and curses never remain in their bodies. They leap away like fleas clinging to new fur.
Love,
it's all Gula says before collapsing. Munzer screams, shaking Gula, tapping her cheeks, caressing the roughness of her face. No response.
Gula, please.
She doesn't respond. Ever since they started traversing the wretched lands in search of russets, their health has been deteriorating. Now Gula is cursed with a corroding evil that will eat her body from the inside in a day or less. She's not prepared to withstand a curse like this.
At least it will be silent, Munzer whispers, her lips fluttering. It will be peaceful.
and she will have one more body to lodge in a grave chamber in the Towers of the Dead.
Munzer closes her fists tight. The specular is curled up behind her table, eyes dampening, not mirroring anymore, but not showing any fear, only pity. The ragdoll is at her feet, pawed hands to the air, shreds coming off its belly.
"Lift her curse, please," Anatu sobs. "You're a curse lifter. Please, I'm sorry."
Munzer kneels before Anatu. She cups her face between black, inflamed hands. She rubs her fingers under the girl's eyes, killing the tears that open tiny paths across the grit of bones and dead herbs that stain her cheeks.
"I can't lift curses. Not anymore." All her healing and assistance skills had been besmirched by dark work and loss-soaked russets since she started cursing lives. She presses Anatu's cheeks, wanting to split the skin, rip the muscles. "You killed my only family."
Anatu blinks away tears but stays silent, unshaken, hands around her knees. Just a hole in the neck. Quick, deep to cut the veins, more merciful than a curse. She runs her hand down to the girl's gaunt neck, her hands daubing it in erratic obsidian, her nails aching for more blood. A hole. She can't do it. Her hands fall. The only thing she sees in the girl is herself not so long ago, swaying in the carriage of an unknown merchant woman who agreed to carry her and three bodies across the wretched lands. She had cried for days while the carriage wiggled across stony roads, getting used to the decaying smell of her mother, father, and brother. Three corpses rotting away, wrapped up in linens and wool, one of them frighteningly smaller than the others. She wards off the memories, chest heaving, a whistling sound escaping with her breath. She lets go of Anatu's cheeks and turns to Gula, still unconscious. Weak as Gula is, she will never wake up. Anatu stands, now clutching the ragdoll between her fingers.
"There are physicians in Urmshar."
"A curse isn't a disease. No physician can save her now."
Munzer pulls one of Gula's arms, but she'll never be able to lift her. She tears a part of her own tunic and wraps it around Gula's head to protect it. Next, she uses Gula's belt to tie her wrists. Lastly, she picks up a worn rope from her bag and ties Gula's ankles. Anatu stares, eyes still gleaming with tears.
"Let me call someone to—"
"Stay away from us."
Munzer drags Gula from the bedroom, pulling her by the rope, yank by yank, Gula's clothing catching on the graveled floor, tearing apart. Her swollen wrists sting, but she can't stop. Gula's body is her responsibility the same way her relatives are.
"Why bring someone you love?"
Anatu stands at her bedroom's door, pinching her lips. Munzer inhales to yell at the girl, but her breath catches and all that comes out is a sob.
"It's never an option," she stutters.
Udrin had tagged along even when she dug a grave for their mother and father, promising the boy she would bring their bodies to the towers soon.
"They stay with you until the end, even when they shouldn't."
Anatu walks forward and bends to lift Gula's shoulders. Munzer raises a hand and mutters,
"Stay away."
Anatu steps back. When Munzer's about to go up the ramp that leads to the courtyard, she pivots to face Anatu one last time.
"Leave this place. Your father is evil."
"No more than I, though. No more."
"Mercy, mercy for my Gula, mercy. Oh, you gods, can't you hear me, please?"
Munzer hauls Gula along the manor's courtyard. The sun's rising. The marble statues in the terraces above glare down as if she's guilty for their lack of arms and legs. Servants and guards utter brief cries of surprise, pointing. A man drops a bucket. A woman kneels and mutters a prayer.
"Call Ortnar."
Munzer gives the order to anyone in particular. She coughs and blood ebbs up her throat. She spits on the floor. Gula's body rubs on the spittle, leaving a trail of crimson, tainting the mangled mosaic of the old courtyard. Steps. The servants' chatter quiets.
"What are you doing?"
Ortnar trudges across the hall. The scruffy red kirtle of a merchant lord flaps behind him, ready to start his day. He stops and the lines on his cheeks ring into a repulsed frown.
What happened to your servitor? Is she...
He comes closer, careful to avoid Gula's body.
Is Anatu done?
Munzer slowly puts down the rope that ties Gula's ankles. She pats a hand on Ortnar's cheek, shivering, her black fingers branding his face with the irregular colors of a curse. He shrieks and tries to step back, moaning, but she snatches his shoulders. Two guards surround them, but Ortnar gestures for them to stay put.
Water, she says.
Ortnar grasps her wrists but quickly recoils when his fingers touch her pustules, the suntan, dried-out skin flailing like shredded curtains.
In the old well, behind the manor.
Anatu appears, coming from the ramp that leads to the basement. Ortnar's lips pinch.
You don't know the losses of my business, Ortnar whispers.
Munzer slides her nails on the marks her hands had left on his cheek. She digs in, ripping his flesh. Ortnar cringes, reeling back. He falls on his knees, fear and hate dousing his eyes. Munzer drags Gula outside. The guards move to help Ortnar, but they don't attack her. They're afraid. They heard the stories of the corrupted from the School of Assistance. The well is in a barren yard that once must have been a plaza. Excrement, dead bodies, and broken furniture pile up on the corners like monuments to the bane. Houses bend to their sides, half-timbered tiles eaten up by moss. On the crumbled roofs, vultures croak, puncturing the silence of Irmshar. Munzer lifts the bucket from the well and dabs her torn scarf in it. Her hands are cleansed from the soot of the curse. She kneels and scrubs Gula's eyes, ears, hair, wiping the grime that has set on her partner's face since they started walking the wretched lands. It won't help. Nothing will. The fever already burns her body, and no herb or healing technique can help now. Only a curse lifter would do, one that hasn't blemished their craft. When the sun hits the top of the sky, Gula breathes her last, silent like the city. No last words. Love. Her last word was love. Gula's forehead still beads with sweat, little pearls of perspiration. Her skin warms under the sun like Munzer waking up in the wretched lands under a leafless tree, abandoned by the merchant woman and put to lay down among her dead family. It was not until the physician approached in the distance, wavering like a mirage, that she abandoned the thoughts of joining her unburied family in eternal suffering. Munzer dries the sweat from Gula's face with the scarf and leaves it there, a veil hiding the only love she'd found after her world crumbled. The time has arrived to gather up her dead again. Munzer lays the shovel on the ground and sits, leaning against a tree, facing the old cart she has found in Irmshar's trash. Mother, father, and brother are set upon it, exhumed from the shallow graves one day from Irmshar. Beside them, her partner lies shrouded, the linen disturbingly whiter than the others. A horse canters in the woods that separate the clearing from the road that leads to Irmshar. Anatu. The specular dumps a small bag on the ground. These are the russets my father would have paid you, and some more he'd kept for my burial, she says, reining in the horse. The rag doll is tied to the saddle like an amulet. Crusts of black on her forehead surround the red stripes Munzer has left there. He's dead.
I've tried to kill you.
My father did, too. She trots forward and stops closer to Munzer, at a cursed hand's reach. Take it, she points to the bag.
You should take your father to the towers with this.
It's for Gula, for... Anatu peeks over Munzer's shoulders. Your family.
If you don't bury your father, you'll never meet him again.
Anatu remains in silence, still gazing across Munzer's shoulders. I never saw him as a father, she says after a while, and he never treated me like his daughter. And you? Once you're gone, who will bring you to the towers? Munzer lowers her head, a question she has been trying to avoid. She looks down at the cart, at Gula's wrapped body. Munzer notices that one of Gula's hands is sticking out of the linen. Fingers that once touched her face to give love, her wounds to provide cure, her body to bring pleasure. Now they're purple and shriveling.
I don't think it matters. I wanted my brother to meet our parents.
And do you think he wouldn't like to see you?
Munzer's belly churns. For Udrin, his sister was everything. Her presence in his afterlife would fill him with joy and completeness. But would he ever be able to forget that it had been she who slid a knife through his neck? Would she be capable of staring into those small, playful eyes?
Anatu yanks the ragdoll from the saddle and hands it to Munzer, who takes it. Carry this with you, Anatu says. People around the Wretched Lands know this belongs to Urmshar.
Anatu spurs her horse.
When your time has come, I'll find you.
That was Renan Bernardo's Curselifter, as read by Avon Shore. Avon Shore is an audiobook narrator, beekeeper, and friend to chickens. She lives and works from a home studio in the woods of rural Canada. Thank you, Avon.
Well, children of the night, the hour is late, and we've run out of tales to tell. For now. Tales to Terrify is made possible by the tremendous generosity of our supporters on Patreon and PayPal. Incredible fans like Lessel Baxter, Paul Belcher, Amanda Carrillo, Amanda Gottfried, and Orion D. Higra, whose generous support helps keep the lights on and flickering ominously. Not a supporter already? Head over to patreon.com/talestoterrify, where you'll find all kinds of perks, like ad-free episodes, bonus content, and one-of-a-kind collectibles and merch packs. Every dollar goes back into this show to make it as horrific as possible, and we appreciate it so much. Want another way to support the show that doesn't cost a cent? Head over to Podchaser, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, and leave us a 5-star rating or review. You'll not only put an unnaturally wide smile on our faces, but help new listeners discover our terrifying tales, too. Why not share your love of the show out in the world with some Tales to Terrify merch? TalesToTerrify.com/merch will take you to our TeePublic store, where we've got a great collection of creepy custom and curated designs, so you can show those around you just how twisted you truly are. Tales to Terrify is produced by Seth Williams, Meredith Morgenstern, Andrew Gibson, Crystal Hammond, Spencer Disparti, and myself, Drew Sebastini, with original theme by Nebulous Entertainment. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Join us again next week as we feast on the forbidden with more Tales to Terrify.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.